to find a solution.
Should be able to give them set boats and, you know, better, like, accommodation to come over on rather than just a dinghy that's probably going to sink halfway across. Like, we've got the boats, we've got, like, all the lifeguards and everything. We could be helping save more than anything, do you know what I mean? We have lifeguards that swim the channels on a night time to make sure everything's all good. So we could be making things a lot safer, and communication with the other governments as well is even better. Like,
it doesn't matter what their, like, what country they came from, but their life matters. So they should be taken care of. They should have been taken care of.
Not all the immigrants are genuine immigrants. Most of them, they are economic immigrants. So finding ways to support them in their own country so they don't have to cross the borders. First place, if they have come over risking their lives, then find the ways to settle them.
Create a safe passage. That's all we need, is a safe passage. They shouldn't be risking their lives in the first place. Otherwise, they are complicit in what's happening.
Again, I think we need to put something into place, a more meaningful policy in place to give these people a chance to have their story heard, to have their situation checked.
The 27 migrants who drowned in the English Channel as they tried unsuccessfully to reach British shores made the headlines. These fatalities also provoked a bitter war of words between British and French politicians after UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson attacked French authorities and, by implication, the French President himself, Emmanuel Macron, for failing to prevent the crossings.
Many make these dangerous journeys because of the impact of British conflicts on their homelands. A number of observers now believe that Britain must accept responsibility for causing much of the migrant problem. It seems a tragic irony that after travelling thousands of perilous kilometres from their war-torn homelands, desperate migrants seeking a new life drown within sight of the very country that turned them into refugees.
Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has said Texas's redistricting plan would violate the Voting Rights Act by discriminating against minority voters. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Katie Benner, Nick Coresaniti, and Reed Epstein. The piece is titled Justice Department Files Voting Rights Suit Against Texas Over New Map. U.S. Justice Department sued Texas on Monday, 6th of December, over the state's plan to redraw its voting district, saying it would essentially make ballots cast by black and Latino voters count for less than those of others. In announcing the lawsuit, Attorney General Merrick Garland said that the redistricting plan that the state's Republican-led legislature approved in October violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which says that voters cannot be denied equal access to the political process based on their race or ethnicity. The lawsuit was the second in a little over a month to be filed by the Justice Department challenging Texas over voting. The department sued the state in early November over a new voting law that it argued would disenfranchise Texans who do not speak English, people with disabilities, older voters, and those who live outside of the United States. The lawsuit filed by the department on Monday also puts other states on notice as they redraw their voting districts, a process that occurs once a decade. 17 states have already finalized congressional maps this year, with more expected to complete the process before the spring. The Texas plan not only denies black and Latino voters the equal opportunity to participate in the election process, some aspects of the plan were created with discriminatory intent, Associate Attorney General Vanita Gupta said at a news conference. The lawsuit laid down several examples where minority districts were eliminated altogether or redrawn in such a way that minority voters in urban areas were newly counted in rural, predominantly white areas. In the case of voters in Dallas, those new districts could extend more than 100 miles from the city center. The suit intensified a running battle between the Biden administration and Texas, a state that defied federal guidance on the use of face masks to stop the spread of COVID-19 and that passed a near-total ban on abortion that the U.S. Justice Department, in another lawsuit, has called unconstitutional. Ken Paxton, Texas's Attorney General, called the redistricting lawsuit absurd and a ploy by the Biden administration. "I'm confident that our legislature's redistricting decisions will be proven lawful, and this preposterous attempt to sway democracy will fail," Ken Paxton said on Twitter. Lawsuit, even if it succeeds, is unlikely to change the enacted Texas maps before the midterm elections next November, when control of Congress is at stake. A decade ago, litigation over Republican-drawn districts in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and elsewhere took years before courts ordered new lines drawn. The Texas candidate filing deadline is next week, and primary elections are set for 1st of March. The federal lawsuit will face significant hurdles in court. Unlike in past decades, Texas did not have to submit its maps for prior clearance by the U.S. Justice Department under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which the Supreme Court neutered in 2013. The Justice Department now has the burden of proving the Texas maps violate federal law, as opposed to Texas being required to demonstrate they're legal. The Supreme Court decision also eliminated the ability to sue states under the Voting Rights Act in federal court in Washington, D.C. Instead, the lawsuit against Texas was filed in El Paso, meaning any appeal would go through the Fifth Circuit, which is stacked with conservative judges. They have a major home court advantage in Texas because you go to the Fifth Circuit, said Tom Perez, former head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division and former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, who is now running for the governor of Maryland. Tom Perez added, "The oldest play in the far-right playbook, whether it's voting rights, abortion rights, labor rights, is go to court in Texas." The lawsuit follows a 2019 Supreme Court ruling that significantly weakened the legal grounds for challenging voter maps. In Rocho versus Common Cause, the court ruled that partisan gerrymandering, maps designed to favor a political party, could not be challenged in federal court, though racial gerrymandering remained unconstitutional. The Justice Department does have an advantage from one element of the law, though the lawsuit makes numerous claims that Texas lawmakers drew intentionally discriminatory maps. There is no requirement that the Justice Department prove intent to successfully challenge the Texas maps under the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act set up vote dilution, and vote dilution does not have to prove intent, said Thomas Sanez, the president of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. The lawsuit over redistricting comes as President Joe Biden and congressional Democrats face pressure to challenge Republican state legislatures around the nation that have sought to curb voting access. Even though the Justice Department has sued Georgia and Texas over laws limiting ballot access and filed statements of support in lawsuits brought by private plaintiffs in Florida and Arizona about laws in those states, those new statutes could be in effect for multiple election cycles before the courts decide whether they are constitutional. Merrick Garland said the Biden administration has only a limited ability to keep states from enacting discriminatory voting laws, even though the Justice Department has prioritized the issue and doubled its enforcement staff, because the 2013 Supreme Court decision ended the department's authority to approve or deny voting laws and redistricting plans before they went into effect. He asked Congress on Monday, 6th of December, to restore that power to the Justice Department through legislation, and said the Texas redistricting plan and other measures that the administration believes curbs minority access to the ballot box would not have been enacted if the department had retained that authority. Currently, there are two bills stuck in the Democratic-controlled yet deadlocked Congress, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, that would seek to both roll back some of the new restrictions on voting and restore the oversight powers of the U.S. Justice Department. But with near unanimous Republican opposition to both bills, there is little likelihood of passage without reforming Senate rules, a path multiple Democrats, including Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, do not support. I don't know what more is going to take before the U.S. Senate realizes that Republicans have zero interest in having fair voting rights in this country, said Trey Martinez-Fisher, a Democratic Texas state representative who organized his colleagues to flee the state in July to delay the passage of Republicans of new voting restrictions in the state. The 2020 census showed that non-Latino white Texans now comprise less than 40% of the state's population, the Justice Department lawsuit said. But the lawsuit said that the redistricting plan created by Republicans refused to recognize the state's growing minority electorate. Texas's population jumped by 4 million between 2010 and 2020. And the increase in the number of minority residents accounted for 95% of that overall growth. Career lawyers in the U.S. Justice Department's Civil Rights Division found that the state's new voting districts will dilute the increased minority voting strength that should have developed from these shifts. Vanita Gupta said, while Texas will gain two additional congressional seats based on millions of new minority citizens, the Justice Department found that those seats will have white voting majorities. The redistricting plan also surgically excised minority communities from the core of the Dallas-Fort Worth metro area metroplex by attaching them to heavily Anglo rural counties some more than 100 miles away, the Justice Department lawsuit said. Based on the population changes, the lawsuit said that proportional representation for Latino voters in Texas would be 11 congressional seats and 45 Texas House seats, but that the new maps provide just 7 congressional seats and 29 Texas House seats. The Justice Department is asking the courts to force Texas to create and implement a new redistricting plan and to establish interim plans that remedy the components of its current redistricting plan that are deemed to be unlawful.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
French President Emmanuel Macron wrapped up his two-day tour of the Persian Gulf after a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman on Saturday. During Macron's visit to Jeddah, he and the Saudi Crown Prince discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis hit Lebanon. Beirut has been suffering from an economic crisis exacerbated by a diplomatic dispute between Lebanon and some Arab Persian Gulf states, especially Saudi Arabia, which had blocked imports. The rift between Riyadh and Beirut was sparked when former Lebanese Information Minister George Kurdahi criticized the Saudi-led military campaign in Yemen. Macron landed in Jeddah after visiting the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. His visit marked the first meeting of a Western leader with Mohammed bin Salman since the assassination of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul back in 2018. Evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed that a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. U.S. intelligence services revealed that the gruesome killing of Khashoggi was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman. Macron's visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accused the French president of trying to rehabilitate bin Salman. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip, given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations, such as the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, threatening activists, imprisoning human rights defenders, slaughtering Yemeni civilians, and so forth. Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. However, in a stark contradiction to his assertion, the French president signed a multi-billion dollar military contract on the previous day with the UAE during his visit to the country as part of his tour.
The reality is that France will put money, will put business, will put profits before human rights, before freedom, and before democracy. And the French are very keen to expand their military relationship with Saudi Arabia, partly to increase the amount of revenue they receive from their annual weaponry sales to the kingdom, but also to compete with British military sales to the kingdom.
The UAE plays a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and millions more displaced, in what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. During the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf, Macron gave a visit to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes. Rights bodies slammed the agreement, blaming the UAE for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US.
France is a leading friend and ally to the Saudis. And on top of that, Saudi Arabia is the leading exporter and financier of terrorism in the world. And so, given that France has a strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia, demonstrates that not only is France complicit in terrorism, as is Britain and France, but also Paris has no regard whatsoever for human rights, democracy, or freedom.
Another country that has provided support for the Saudi regime despite its violations of human rights in Yemen is the United States. Last month, the Pentagon announced that the State Department had approved the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The missile sale followed the U.S. approval of a $500 million helicopter maintenance deal for the kingdom in September. The fact that the U.S. and France are the largest weapons exporters to Saudi Arabia brings one to the conclusion that Washington and Paris are only after selling their military hardware despite the war crimes Riyadh is committing. and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives and displacement of millions more during the ongoing war on Yemen.
Simmering tensions over Ukraine threaten to pit the United States and its allies against the Russian Federation. The West has repeatedly accused Russia of preparing for an invasion as the Russian army has deployed tens of thousands of troops near the border with Ukraine. Moscow insists that it has the right to deploy forces on its own territory as it sees fit, accusing Kiev of pursuing its own buildup near the border. Russia also says it feels threatened by NATO's deepening ties with its southern neighbor, and that Ukraine is becoming increasingly involved in U.S. geopolitical games in the region. So much must be at stake in the ongoing tug of war because neither side seems willing to give an inch as tensions skyrocket between the West and Russia amid warnings that the situation could quickly spiral out of control.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to control and destabilize Eastern Europe, the Balkan region. We saw that after the fall of Yugoslavia, with the U.S. and the United Nations sending troops into the region to prop up and maintain pro-capitalist, pro-American leaders.
In an attempt to defuse the standoff, American and Russian diplomats sat down for talks in Stockholm on Thursday on the sidelines of a meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The short duration of their meeting and the fact that the two opted not to appear together afterwards has given observers an impression that there is no chance of a breakthrough, at least not for now. The two top diplomats are believed to have traded threats during their brief meeting. Both remained very defiant after their talks, an indication of how deep-rooted their differences are. The United States and Russia are making no secret of their mounting tensions, as top diplomats from the two sides are using bellicose language. That leaves little doubt about the gravity of the latest crisis. Blinken told his Russian counterpart that America would take unprecedented high-impact economic measures against the Russians in support of Ukraine. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, quote, ignoring Russia's legitimate concerns, Ukraine's involvement in U.S. geopolitical games amid the deployment of NATO forces near our borders will have the most serious consequences.
In the case of Ukraine, I think the Russian government has a right to be concerned that Ukraine, the Ukrainian government, is being played as a puppet of U.S. financial interests, U.S. political interests.
Ukraine has been the main scene of geopolitical rivalry between the West and Russia for years now. The Russian Federation believes NATO wants to draw Ukraine deeper into its sphere of influence and place missile systems on Russia's borders. Moscow has demanded legally binding security guarantees that will not happen. Meanwhile, the West accuses Moscow of funding and supporting pro-Russian forces in the Donbas region, something Moscow has denied. The Ukraine equation is very complicated, and it is hard to predict how the situation will evolve. Both Russia and the United States have suggested that Presidents Biden and Putin may need to hold talks on the crisis very soon. But nothing is guaranteed on the ground, even if the two presidents discuss a standoff, because the latest escalation comes a few months after Putin and Biden sat down in Geneva for talks that mainly focused on Ukraine.
Deep-seated racism and Islamophobia once again resurfaced in the United States following threats and insults against Muslim House Representative Ilhan Omar. Lauren Barber, far-right Republican congresswoman, insulted Omar by suggesting that she was a terrorist to a crowd at her own state of Colorado. Bobart described encountering Omar at the U.S. Capitol and being relieved that she does not have a backpack, an apparent reference to Omar possibly carrying a bomb. Bobart further insulted Omar by describing her as a member of the Jihad Squad.
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that this isn't new in the context of racism in America, and that America has been a racist country since its founding. I think it's important to always understand or do your analysis of this issue with that being the underlying premise.
Last week, Bobart apologized to anyone in the Muslim community that she may have offended, but refused to directly refer to Omar. Following Bobart's refusal to apologize, the Muslim Democrat congresswoman received a racist, death threat-laden voicemail left for her. In a news conference on Tuesday, Omar called on Republican leadership, who have so far declined to punish Bobart over the comments, to stand up to anti-Muslim hate. Omar, who became the first Somali-American and naturalized citizen of African birth to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives when she was elected in the year 2018, said the voicemail came through shortly after Bobart posted another video on social media on Monday. "We cannot pretend this hate speech from leading politicians does not have real consequences," she said.
Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, his refusal to call out Congresswoman Lauren Boebert is an example of how morally bankrupt, how ethically vacuous individuals like this are, because they're always going to make the political calculation of how their constituents are going to respond to something like this instead of being a leader in a situation like this.
The latest insults heaped against Ilhan Omar have once again revealed the toxic environment against Muslims in the United States. Shortly after the 9/11 attacks, many Muslims became the targets of anger and racism. Mosques were burned or destroyed, and death threats and harassment followed many Muslims in the weeks following the attacks. Hate crimes against Muslims rose over 1,600% from the year 2000 to 2001. But even as the country moved further from the attacks and the Muslim American population in the country grew, discrimination against this community has not waned.
And so where we are now, in terms of the intra-party struggle that we're seeing, inter- and intra-party struggle, where you have Congresswoman Boebert calling Congresswoman Omar a terrorist, that now is a result of Trumpian politics.
Anti-Muslim sentiment continued during the 2016 election cycle, during which Islamophobic hate crimes surged again. It is widely believed that the rise in hate to the anti-Muslim rhetoric was linked to the political discourse espoused by the political establishment in the U.S., especially the Republican Party and the people who gathered around former U.S. President Donald Trump, who made Islam and Muslims targets of criticism throughout his presidential campaign and tenure.
It's going to continue to be incredibly divisive from a domestic perspective, and it is going to, I think, drive more and more and more white supremacist, white nationalist policy, whether it be domestic or whether it be foreign. And I also think from a domestic violence perspective, we are going to see more and more examples of individuals taking matters into their own hands, using their own firearms, and attacking fellow citizens.
During the first months of the Trump administration, it was reported that roughly 75% of Muslim American adults said that there's a lot of discrimination against Muslims in the U.S. Shortly into his time in office, Trump signed an executive order that barred immigrants from several Muslim-majority countries. Islam has been seen in the Western world in a negative light, which is fueling the wave of Islamophobic attacks on Muslims.
Simmering tensions over Ukraine threaten to pit the United States and its allies against the Russian Federation. The West has repeatedly accused Russia of preparing for an invasion as the Russian army has deployed tens of thousands of troops near the border with Ukraine. Moscow insists that it has the right to deploy forces on its own territory as it sees fit, accusing Kiev of pursuing its own buildup near the border. Russia also says it feels threatened by NATO's deepening ties with its southern neighbor, and that Ukraine is becoming increasingly involved in U.S. geopolitical games in the region. So much must be at stake in the ongoing tug of war because neither side seems willing to give an inch as tensions skyrocket between the West and Russia amid warnings that the situation could quickly spiral out of control.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to control and destabilize Eastern Europe, the Balkan region. We saw that after the fall of Yugoslavia with the U.S. and the United Nations sending troops into the region to prop up and maintain pro-capitalist, pro-American leaders.
In an attempt to defuse the standoff, American and Russian diplomats sat down for talks in Stockholm on Thursday on the sidelines of a meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The short duration of their meeting and the fact that the two opted not to appear together afterwards has given observers an impression that there is no chance of a breakthrough, at least not for now. The two top diplomats are believed to have traded threats during their brief meeting. Both remained very defiant after their talks, an indication of how deep-rooted their differences are. The United States and Russia are making no secret of their mounting tensions as top diplomats from the two sides are using bellicose language. That leaves little doubt about the gravity of the latest crisis. Blinken told his Russian counterpart that America would take unprecedented high-impact economic measures against the Russians in support of Ukraine. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, quote, ignoring Russia's legitimate concerns, Ukraine's involvement in U.S. geopolitical games amid the deployment of NATO forces near our borders will have the most serious consequences. Ukraine has been the main scene of geopolitical rivalry between the West and Russia for years now. The Russian Federation believes NATO wants to draw Ukraine deeper into its sphere of influence and place missile systems on Russia's borders. Moscow has demanded legally binding security guarantees that that will not happen. Meanwhile, the West accuses Moscow of funding and supporting pro-Russian forces in the Donbas region, something Moscow has denied. The Ukraine equation is very complicated, and it is hard to predict how the situation will evolve. Both Russia and the United States have suggested that Presidents Biden and Putin may need to hold talks on the crisis very soon. But nothing is guaranteed on the ground, even if the two presidents discuss a standoff. Because the latest escalation comes a few months after Putin and Biden sat down in Geneva for talks that mainly focused on Ukraine.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, today we're going to continue our discussion about Imam Khomeini's views on the armed forces. Please stay with us. The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes in his testament, "In Iran, where this miracle of the age, the Islamic Revolution, was worked by the people, the committed armed forces and the pure and patriotic commanders had a significant share. And today, as Saddam's war that has been imposed by the order and support of America and other superpowers has faced a political and military defeat by the invading Ba'athist army and its powerful supporters and their lackeys, it is again the armed forces and the new law enforcement forces, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps and popular forces, who created this great honor in the fronts with the unsparing support of the nation. They made Iran proud, and the internal mischief and plots that had been mobilized by the puppets affiliated to the East and the West to overthrow the Islamic Republic were thwarted by the able hands of the younger generation of the Islamic Revolutionary Committees, the besieged volunteer forces, the police, with the help of the brave people. It is the same dear selfness, younger generation, who stay awake at night so that their families rest calmly. May God bless them." The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, continues, "I recommend kindly to all armed forces, in the end of the life of this world, just as they have been loyal, to be firmly loyal to Islam, which is the only religion of independence and freedom, and Almighty God has invited all to the lofty human status with its light of guidance. It is Islam that rescues you, your country, and your nation from the strain of dependence and affiliation to the powers who do not want you except for their slavery, and keep your dear country and nation backward and the consumption market and under the shameful oppression. Prefer noble human life, even with problems, to the shameful life of slavery of foreigners, even if it is with animal welfare." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes further in his testament, my brotherly recommendation in the final steps of my life to the armed forces generally is that, O dear ones, who love Islam and continue self-sacrifice in the France and all over the country with the love of meeting God, be vigilant and alert as the political players and the West-toxicated and East-toxicated professional politicians and stealthy, mysterious hands have focused the sharp weapon of treachery and crime from every side towards you, dear ones, more than any other group, and they want to exploit your dear ones who have made the revolution victorious and revived Islam with your sacrifices to topple the Islamic Republic. And they want to separate you from Islam, and they want you to separate from the nation, and they don't want you to serve the country, and they want to throw you in the lap of one of the two world-devouring powers, and they want to nullify your efforts and sacrifices by political deception, tricks, in the Islamic and national form. Imam Khomeini then refers to the backwardness of Iran, saying, after this, much of artificial backwardness to the great industries of the foreign countries, our need is an undeniable reality. This does not mean that we should be dependent on one of the superpowers in the advanced sciences. The government and the army should make effort to send committed students to the countries which have great advanced industries, while they're not colonialists and exploiters, and they should refrain from sending the students to America and the Soviet Union and other countries which are in the direction of these two poles. Perhaps, God willing, one day will come that these two powers will come to their senses and march in the path of humanity and humanitarianism and respect other people's rights. Or, God willing, the downtrodden of the world and the vigilant nations and committed Muslims will put them in their places. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes further in his testament, know that as long as you extend your hand to others in advanced industries and spend your life in begging, the power of innovation and advancement in inventions would not flourish within you. And you saw clearly that in this short period after the economic sanctions, those who considered themselves unable to make anything and were disappointed of driving factories, put their thoughts into action and met many needs of the army and factories themselves. And this war, the economic sanction and expulsion of the foreign experts, were a divine gift, which we were negligent of. Now, if the government and the army sanctioned the goods of the world devourers and increased their effort in the way of innovation, it is hoped that the country will be self-sufficient and will be saved from begging the enemy. The late Imam Khomeini continued by saying, we saw that many factories and advanced tools like aircrafts and other industrialized goods, which were not thought to be started by Iranian specialists, and all hands were extended towards the West and the East so that their specialists would start them. As a result of the economic sanction and the imposed war, our dear young people have made the needed parts and supplied them in lower prices, and have proved that we can if we want to.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
said Aminolemi Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Thousands of Yemeni people have filled the streets and cities of Aden, Taiz and Mukalla in southern Yemen to protest against the government of former Saudi-backed President Abdurrabbah Mansour Hadi. Protesters condemned the widespread poverty and the deterioration of public services within areas controlled by the Saudi-backed government.
We hold the Saudi-led coalition fully responsible for what the situation has reached, the spread of poverty and the decrease in the prices of the local currency. We are suffering to obtain flour and gas for our children.
We have a country that has oil and wealth, but unfortunately we are poor because of the corrupt government. They receive their money in dollars and Saudi riyals, and here salaries are worth nothing against foreign currencies and are not enough to provide a living.
Observers say the Saudi-backed Hadi regime has failed to maintain the local currency rate even though it is not facing a siege or economic war like is happening in Sana'a. They say the departure of all the Saudi-led coalition forces is the only way to end the humanitarian crisis.
The living situation in the southern regions is bad and the economic deterioration has reached a staggering level. And there are no attempts to stop this collapse by the Saudi-led coalition and its forces in the occupied areas. The free people there must demand the expulsion of the occupation, the cessation of printing the local currency without a cash cover, and the creation of economic alternatives that guarantee the Yemenis a decent life.
On March 2015, the Saudi-led coalition occupied several cities in southern Yemen, including Aden. Since then, these areas have been facing a tragic situation as the prices keep increasing due to the continued depreciation of the currency.
The economic situation in the occupied areas is getting day after day, causing a massive increase in the prices of food and other basic commodities. Observers say the situation is like a famine hitting these areas amid the continued silence of the international community.
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbas and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation, an all-out technology and trade blockade, and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity inside. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the US. And talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing. The Anglo-Saxons respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the US.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to these could be long-term security guarantees on its western borders. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Scores of disabled people and their families in the Gaza Strip came out to mark the International Day of Disabled Persons. They held a sit-in in front of the Ministry of Social Development to mark the annual international event. The Palestinian Non-Governmental Organizations Network, which organized the event, accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting civilians, including people with disabilities, during the recent war on the Gaza Strip. Last May, Israeli regime forces killed hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children, during the wanton bombing of thousands of buildings in the blockaded enclave.
Tens of people became people with disability because of the Israeli offensive on the Gaza Strip. Also, four people with disability were killed in the last offensive. This year, we witnessed deterioration in the socio-economic conditions of people with disability because of the continuous illegal blockade imposed by Israel.
Currently, there are more than 50,000 disabled persons in the blockaded coastal enclave. Thousands of Palestinians in the impoverished territory became disabled during four Israeli wars since 2008. Scores more also suffered permanent disabilities during the 2018 Great March of Return peaceful rallies against Israeli occupation.
An Israeli sniper shot me while I was protesting peacefully during the Great March of Return in 2018 and I became disabled. I want the whole world to know that the Zionist regime is an illegitimate entity that occupies our land and doesn't understand the meaning of peace and only believe in violence and aggression.
During the last offensive, Israeli forces injured over 2,200 Palestinians, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability.
The world community is standing silent for the crimes of Israel. All the time they attack the children, women, and this even disabled people, hospitals, schools. But the problem that the international community is keeping silent, and there is no actions, no measure taken against Israel and to impose sanction or repression on Israel to stop its aggression against our people.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has made it even worse for disabled Gazans who require rehabilitation and artificial limbs.
Experts say thousands of Palestinians in the besieged enclave have suffered from various disabilities in recent years due to Israel's use of internationally banned weapons against the civilian population. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
After a long hunger strike that lasted for 131 days to protest against his detention without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Kaid Al-Fasfous has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released Al-Fasfous from the Israeli hospital of Barzilai, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition because of his hunger strike. He arrived first at his hometown Doura village in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Then he headed to the grave of later President Yasser Arafat in Ramallah. He sent a message to the other prisoners to remain steadfast, reminding them that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
As I did it, my brothers who are on hunger strike will do it. It was not an easy experience at all. Me and the other prisoners went through difficult days and circumstances. We had been beaten, oppressed, and held in solitary confinement, and had been transferred frequently from one prison to another.
Israel arrested Al-Fasfous in October 2020, and it was not his first detention. He was arrested several times in the past, but this time he was